Hello, I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and welcome to this episode of Live from Lord North Street. Two of the main parties in Her Majesty's opposition, the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats, have had their party conferences and put forward a slew of new policies. Joining me to discuss the Labour Party conference and the policy proposals put forward there is the IEA's Kate Andrews. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Darren.
Kate argues that despite the tax burden creeping at a 50-year high, the Labour Party called for increasing taxes and a slew of public spending commitments. Kate, what were some of the spending commitments and tax increases that you speak of?
So some of the specific ones that came out that were new in this party conference, including free personal care for the elderly, so having more people dependent on essentially nationalised social care, which was estimated to be an additional £8 billion. It's thought that the social care budget currently is in about a £6 billion black hole, so that's more than doubling what would need to be spent on social care. But we heard a lot of the same policy proposals that have been put forward before about free tuition fees, slashing tuition fees, free universal access to childcare, really completely uncosted, racking up billions and billions and billions of pounds of public spending, and it hasn't been said where it would come from. And, you know, the real concern, of course, is that when you commit to this kind of public spending, it has to be paid off by somebody at some point, and it's usually those future taxpayers, those younger generations, that have to pay off today's big spending commitments, and it's actually quite unfair.
But they do argue that this would only be tax increases on the top 5%, don't they?
They claim that. Because it's uncosted, it's very hard to know whether or not their tax increases would actually cover what would be spent publicly, especially as this really seems to be the tip of the iceberg, what they're proposing, not necessarily the full spending platter that they would put forward if they were in charge. But, you know, you have to be very, very careful about where people always claim money's coming from, because if you are going to renationalize railways, if you're going to have universal free access to childcare, in many circumstances like those too, if you're actually going to have poor people topping up the lifestyles of middle-class people who tend to take trains and who tend to depend on more traditional forms of childcare, you never know who's going to get taxed down the road and who's going to have to pay for those public services, which, as we know from many different sectors of society, tend not to be as efficient when they're run by the state.
And then the Labour Party also put forward a proposal for a four-day working week, which seems to be becoming more and more popular. And this sounds fantastic, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to only work 4 days a week?
Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful proposal if it were the case that people would get paid the same salary for working 4 days a week as opposed to five. When you take out that 20% of work, it's hard to see how employers could possibly pay somebody's full-time salary. You could certainly see a scenario where many were forced into looking for more work in addition to their full-time job in order to pay the bills, which is a huge amount of stress if you no longer know where your full income is coming from. It's automatically assumed that everybody would be thrilled with this because, you know, the system is difficult, it wears us down, people want to work less and live more. But I actually think there's some really interesting sort of wonky statistics around this that listeners might find interesting. So the labor force survey data actually shows that the UK has a rather wide range of different kinds of contracts that can allow for different working hours across the board. So this idea that there really is only one way to work in the UK, you must be working, you know, 40 plus hours a week, you must have this full-time job that's Monday through Friday, really isn't the case. There's pretty flexible working environment out there that has a lot of different kinds of choice into whether or not you want to work part-time or full-time. Also from the IEA's own book, Working to Rule, we've looked and compared across countries, and it doesn't seem that the UK working hours are out of line with other developed countries. Actually, they're very much in line with other European countries that people often think of as being much more generous to their employees in terms of time off, but the UK's pretty much in line. But the most interesting one is that when Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party talk about these workers who could do with the time off, they're always implying that they're people who are at the lower end of the pay spectrum. They're people who, you know, are in really difficult jobs, you know, not being treated very nicely at work, the people who are really having a rough time of it. But actually, the people who tend to work more than 48 hours a week tend to be people at the top. They tend to be the highest earners. People who are in managerial roles, directors and senior officials are much more likely as a percentage of all employees to be working more than 48 hours a week than people who are, say, in service occupations or sales occupations. So while people like Jeremy Corbyn and while people in the Labour Party try to paint the four-day working week as the working man and woman's policy proposal, actually the people they'd be getting off work tend to be the people at the top earning the most. So it really isn't obvious at all that this is a policy for the working class or for people who are at the lower end of the pay spectrum. Those people, if they could only work 4 days a week, really might have to look for secondary employment, really might have to look for that second job. That's a burden. That's a stress, not necessarily knowing where your pay is coming from. It's not obviously at all something that would help workers at the bottom.
And then Kate, as someone who recognises the broad principles of free trade, universally agreed by economists to bring benefits and boost living standards for the economy at large, what did you think of the Labour Party attack on a US trade deal and the argument that this would just lead to a privatisation of the National Health Service?
I think it's an easy talking point to bring up the NHS in the context of a US-UK free trade deal, especially as because President Trump at one point did imply that the NHS could be on the table. But I think at that time it was pretty much debunked as an idea that the NHS would have to be on the table. Of course, you know, in many other circumstances, including a US-UK free trade deal, no deal is better than a bad deal, and the UK does not have to sign up to a trade deal that puts the NHS on the table. But also, you know, let's just look at the hard facts of this. American companies are already able to bid and sometimes win NHS contracts. This would not be a new thing. This is something that happens now without that direct free trade deal. So I think it's a bit of a political storm in a teacup, and it's an easy way to put people off the idea of free trade. And perhaps this goes to the broader point, and maybe the most frustrating thing in Jeremy Corbyn's speech yesterday was that he made a compelling case for wealth and power being in the hands of the many. That was his direct quote. But taking a negative view of free trade directly contradicts what he's trying to achieve. It's almost universally agreed by economists that free trade benefits all parties. It benefits both countries that enter into the bilateral deal. It benefits customers, it benefits sellers, it benefits importers and exporters. Free trade makes us all wealthier and more prosperous. And it also empowers people by giving them choice. And so I do wish that if the Labour leader, you know, were really committed to this idea of giving people more power, more choice, and more control over their own lives, he would be more receptive to the ideas of free enterprise and free trade. Because taking a more nationalist approach to things like this tends to cutting people off from the rest of the world tends to make you and your citizens poorer.
And what was the policy proposal put forward for compulsory licensing of medication?
So Jeremy Corbyn wants to get the drug companies to sell their drugs for cheaper, to make them more accessible on the NHS.
Because if you're an average consumer reading the headline, you'd probably think, wow, this sounds like it would have great consequences for people who genuinely need access to medicines, wouldn't you?
The problem with overhauling the patent system, and I should actually say that people of a free market perspective have internal debates about IP and patents and the rest, but I think one of the problems with overhauling such a system is that you take away the innovation and you take away the incentive to come up with essentially medical marvels, innovations in drugs and healthcare and that new technology. And by removing all the profit motive from healthcare and the profit motive to create these drugs, I think you're likely to worsen the problems that already exist in the NHS, rationing, limited patient choice, and a lack of innovation in the market for drugs and new treatment. So while it sounds all good and well to make healthcare companies reduce the cost of their drugs, you may end up with fewer drugs. You may end up with no access to them at all. You may end up with fewer experimental drugs, and you're very likely to end up with less innovation in the sector. Now, you know, if you are really striving for equality, having no innovative new cancer drug, I guess, is more equal than having one that can only be accessed by some people at some points. I suppose if you really are striving for the most equal society that you can create, then making sure that a drug isn't accessible to anyone, as opposed to being accessible to some people for a while, is technically more equal, but I don't believe it's ideal, because eventually those patents do fade away and people are able to access a drug that can save millions and millions of people's lives. It is part of the process, and it's a difficult one, and I'm by no means saying that the system is perfect, but to simply overhaul it and to force companies to sell their drugs cheaper probably means limited access to new and innovative drugs down the road.
And then, Kate, I wonder if to end, you can imagine for a moment, Jeremy Corbyn calls you up and he says,
hey, Kate, Jeremy.
He says, Kate, I'm getting you in. And you say, right, okay. And you wander off to Labour HQ and he says, everything in my manifesto that I've put forward, that policies that I've put forward at conference, at our last conference, involved more state bureaucracy and interference in the economy. Do you think this is a good idea? Would you turn around and tell him what history tells us? Does history tell us that this is a good idea? What do you think?
I'd love to have a phone call with Jeremy Corbyn. He'd actually be at the top of the list. Well, the first thing I'd say if he invited me in is, it'd be tragic to leave the IA. The first thing I'd probably say is that I'm more than happy to take on the drugs and immigration brief, where I think I do agree with the Labour Party on not all of their stances, but many, a more liberal and fair immigration system, and certainly one where we cancel any kind of war on drugs and actually make them legal and safer for people to consume. On the state bureaucracy and the state interference, I'd have a different message. History does tell us, Darren, that it is free enterprise, not state control, that builds everybody up and makes them more prosperous and tends to solve most of society's problems. It's very, very rare that we see big interference from the state actually improve the quality of people's lives. It's the market that does that, and it's choice and it's liberty. In some areas like immigration, I think Jeremy Corbyn is much closer to these principles than he is when it comes to the economy. If you really do want to empower the many, the best referendum one could ever have is to put everything on the market and let people decide.
Well, let's hope he gets you on the phone. Thank you very much, Kate. The Liberal Democrats, formerly that party of Gladstone and economic liberalism, are something of a perennial disappointment to those joining them on the basis that they still believe those things. But my two guests argue that they're not a complete write-off, and they actually attended the conference. So they are Andy Mayer and Emma Revel, both my colleagues. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Darren.
Now, having heard the arguments, having pored through the pamphlets and analysed the policy proposals, what are the prospects, opportunities and challenges for free marketeers from the policies put forward? Andy, I want to go to you first. You remain optimistic about the free market championing by the Lib Dems, but I can see a long list of uncosted and unworkable ideas. So I want to know really where your optimism stems from, because you've got to name a few. 5 billion more in welfare payments, including removing the two-child limit, which some would argue discourages parents to have more kids than they can afford to raise. So you'd break that link with personal responsibility. You've got 6 billion more for the NHS and social care, just pouring more money at this system which isn't working. And 50 billion for regional policy, which I assume is a sort of regional inequality style fund. So where does your optimism come from given all of these policies and spending commitments?
Well, Darren, I think it's fair to say that the Liberal Democrats' thinking on economics has been dominated by the social market school of thought, and also by local politics. So the tribes of the Liberal Democrats, we do have free market liberals, they do have social market thinkers, and they do have localists who really don't care that much about the economics, but just like to get things done. Mm-hmm. And within those groups, definitely the social market group has been in the ascendancy for most of the post-coalition period. I think there was a lot of disenchantment in the Liberal Democrats after Nick Clegg had left, and Nick Clegg was widely perceived as being on the Orange Book or free market liberal wing of the party.
Could you just explain what the Orange Book wing of the party is?
So the Orange Book was a publication from about 10 to 15 years ago, which set out a number of ideas for the Liberal Democrats in government, which at the time seemed like a far-fetched possibility, that were then implemented when in government by Nick Clegg and the ministers that he appointed in various roles in the coalition government from 2010 to 2015. So those people are still there, and they're getting new people now coming in because of their stance on Brexit. Now, obviously not everybody agrees with what they've done, but it is a very clear position. And as a result, they are attracting pro-European conservatives, many of whom have free market liberal instincts. And they're also attracting refugees from New Labour, those that are still left in the Labour Party, some of whom are attracted to the idea of markets as a solution, perhaps more in a third way context. So amongst those new people, and many of them are extremely young people, there is an enormous opportunity for the free market wing of the Liberal Democrats to reassert themselves. And that's what groups like Liberal Reform are trying to do.
Emma, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think Andy's quite right to mention the different strands within the Liberal Democrats. And obviously that is entirely what you'd expect from a political party that was formed of a merger from two other political parties. So among the older members of the Lib Dems, you have people who were previously members of the SDP, who quite naturally come from quite a social market perspective. But you also then have people who were members of the Liberal Party, and they're the ones who have the economic liberal instincts when it comes to, you know, economic and social policy. I think Andy's also right to mention the younger members. This was the first conference where we've been able to see how those members would vote. And I think it's important to note that Lib Dems at their party conference have a one member, one vote system. And they do vote on all party policy, and they have done for a very long time. So this was the first chance to really see what the new grassroots members, what the new intake thought about, you know, the policies that were under discussion.
So go on then, what do you think this young blood, this new blood into the party, what opportunities were there from the sort of policies that they were voting for? Do you think they were more inclined to back free market, free society policies?
I think they were certainly more inclined to do that than a lot of people expected. So a couple of the things that were debated, a couple of the policies included things like a commitment to bringing in minimum unit alcohol pricing for England. That was a line that was in the motion, and it was requested that that line be voted on specifically because a lot of people had a problem with it. Unfortunately for economic liberals, that vote was lost, but it was only lost by 7 votes, which is much, much closer than a lot of people expected it to be. So although, you know, that we would prefer that was won, as an economic liberal, I'd rather not have minimum unit alcohol pricing. That was a lot closer than they, you know, people expected. So I think there is a strain within the Lib Dems who are pushing back on lifestyle taxes. And hopefully, you know, if they can develop over the next few years, there will be more of them in the party.
So Andy, with this idea of the Lib Dems being a sort of lifeboat for those scrambling away from their former parties, what do you think the opportunities are for free marketeers?
I think you're onto something with the social libertarian trend. I mean, there's very scant evidence of it in the current agenda pack for conference. Most of the proposals put in there were status, but then we need to bear in mind that most of those proposals would have been formulated about 18 months ago, coming through the Liberal Democrats' very complicated policy development process to arrive at conference now, when perhaps they're not quite as suitable. But things like facial recognition technology were in there.
Terrifying.
And, yeah, whether or not the police powers over its use should be curtailed in some way. That's fairly libertarian. Some of the things around planning reform, again, not much, but they noted, for example, that it was a bad thing that people could move in next to music venues and then close those venues down on the basis that they had moved in and complained about the noise using planning regs. So things like that give you some hope that these are things that A, appeal to young people, but also B, appeal to free marketeers.
Mm. And you hear a lot of Lib Dem politicians of late starting their speeches with, and maybe this is sort of, it's gone from the Clegg days that you spoke of earlier, but you hear a Lib Dem politician stand up and start a speech by saying, I'm a free marketeer, or I believe in capitalism, but Rather than I'm a free marketeer or I'm a capitalist because, you know, why? When do you think the Lib Dem faith in open markets began to collapse? Because you mentioned in the introduction, the history of the party, you know, you've got that Gladstonian and economic liberalism. When do you think that started to slide? Do you think that's just a natural trend following what the demands of the electorate? Or do you think the party just is moving in a more sort of social democrat direction?
Well, I think that was a very long time ago. I mean, most social liberals would point to Lloyd George and the People's mm-hmm. Budget, which is over 100 years mm-hmm. ago now, as mm-hmm. the turning point where they moved away from laissez-faire. I think that's reasonable. I mean, the current party is more characterised by not really understanding consistency on these points. So, for example, they argue quite strongly and pleasantly for tax simplification in various parts of their policy agenda, but then go on to create hundreds of new taxes and more complex taxes. So they don't really get it. Another good example historically would be that they were against, say, the poll tax, but in favour of the BBC licence fee because it supported things that they liked, which is another kind of poll tax. And so it goes on. So I think like most political parties and like the electorate, they are quite inconsistent. But at the core of it, if you ask most Liberal Democrats whether they, if it came to the crunch, would prioritise freedom or equality, most would choose freedom. And that is a difference with the Labour Party.
Emma, the party has also pledged, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, to move forward the UK's net zero carbon target by 5 years.
Yes.
Regardless of potential economic costs, especially to those on lower incomes. Do you think this is a problem to those of a free market persuasion?
I think it's definitely worrying because I think most of us on the free market side would argue that even 2050 is wildly optimistic given the current technologies that we have, just the things that would need to be in place to achieve a 2050 net zero emissions target simply do not exist yet, or where they exist, they're far too expensive to implement widely. So the idea of bringing it forward to 2045 is faintly ridiculous. I think this is where, in my experience, and I went to my first Lib Dem conference in 2011, they've always been quite, I'm a free marketeer, but because, you know, that is their natural instinct, a lot of them, that is their starting point. But then they also want to make things better, and they want a sort of equality, and that they don't take from the economic liberal perspective. They take that from a social market kind of perspective. So they then end up taking their economic liberalism but then watering it down in certain ways. And I think this is a good example of that. They're starting from a good place, but actually the policy outcomes that they get to are not, you know, they're not as free market as we would hope they would be.
Andy?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, the intention is always good. I mean, the Liberal Democrats like to see themselves as the nice party, the people who care, and not a party that's just obsessed with power, which can be very difficult for them because it sometimes means that they're not prepared to win elections to actually achieve the things they want to achieve. But they also don't necessarily think through all the tools in the basket in order to achieve those ends. So a good example on climate change is that they want to simultaneously ban fracking but fund carbon capture and storage. Now, the policy that they used to have in this area about 10 years ago was that they would take the proceeds from early fracking, put those into some kind of low carbon fund, and use that fund then to reduce the cost of renewables or to reduce, say, the cost of CCS. CCS they haven't thought through because actually in the UK it makes next to no sense economically. It's one of the most expensive places in the world to try the technology, but they haven't thought that through either. They've just seen that it's a potential environmental solution as a zero carbon or negative carbon technology, and they want to do it. So it's that kind of thing. So the intention's always great, but they don't necessarily look at both sides of the coin whether there's a better way of doing things without the involvement of the state.
Now, we mentioned throughout this podcast, actually, that the Liberal Democrats argue that they're serious about giving voters meaningful choice. Now, I think you've both said that actually the Liberal Democrats could stand out by, you know, being that party now that disaffiliated members of the Conservative Party or the Labour Party are now defecting to. So given that all of these free market, those of a free market persuasion are flocking to the Lib Dems, don't you think actually a way in which they could stand out from the other parties in the mix would be to actually adopt a more classically liberal agenda, and that actually far more than any position on Europe or on climate change could really differentiate them from the others? Is that right? Do you agree with that, Andy?
Well, I think if I said yes, it would be wish fulfillment.
Right. Okay.
I think it's more the case that to make free market ideas popular, they have to be well explained, and sometimes they're harder to explain than simply saying we're going to spend more on some kind of child probation service, or we're going to put money into schools or hospitals. For the Liberal Democrats to do that, there is certainly an instinctive base of how they could, but at the moment I would suggest the drift is more in the other direction, that they need to get a populist platform together to show that they can beat the Labour Party, and that's what will be driving their thinking going into the next election.
Mm-hmm. Emma?
I think the problem electorally for the Lib Dems is always comes down to, in some places they are facing the Labour Party and in some places they're challenging the Conservative Party, and there's always going to be a difference between the Lib Dem MP you elect from a seat in the Southwest where they've managed to fend off the Conservatives, and a Lib Dem MP you elect in Oxford, for example, or a Lib Dem MP that you elect in Scotland where they're facing the SNP. Mm-hmm. These are quite different challenges electorally, and it does mean that on the ground the Lib Dems have to cover all bases and be all things to all people in order to get elected. And then you end up with, I mean, at the minute 18, but who knows how many after the next election, MPs who then have to try and square that circle and come up with a platform that makes consistent sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very difficult to do, and you're always going to end up with some who are a lot more economically liberal than others.
Emma, I wonder if to end, you can imagine, put your thinking cap on, and you imagine Jo Swinson calls you up and she says, "Listen, Emma, I'm getting you in." And you say, "Right, okay." And she says, "Listen, I'm serious about giving voters a meaningful choice between the parties, and I want to do this through a more classically liberal agenda." What would be your advice to her?
I would probably want to look at free market answers to climate change. Because, I mean, this is an issue that's massively in the public domain now. It's something that clearly the Liberal Democrat members want to talk about and they think is an issue that needs tackling, which is why they want to bring the net zero round to 2045. But the ways that they want to do that are not practical and they're not free market. So I'd be looking at policies that, you know, make it easier for companies to develop and then to scale up climate-friendly technologies. I'd be saying, look, you need to, you know, make it easier for companies to invest and then sell climate-friendly, you know, technology, rather than saying, what we should do is ban all cars within 11 years, you know, petrol and diesel cars, and, you know, just scrap plastic entirely. That's not reasonable. They're not free market solutions. And actually, that would be a way to sort of bring together the issues that the party care about, issues that are tackling, issues that are high up what the voters care about, and free market solutions, because this is an area where actually free market answers can solve a really big global problem.
Well, Emma, let's hope she calls you up and unleashes
ready.
The market. Free the market. Thank you very much. Now, next week, you can find out what the IEA thinks of the policies put forward by Her Majesty's government. We'll be at Conservative Party Conference, and this podcast will be coming to you live from Manchester. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is you get your podcasts.